This time on the Plutopia Podcast, author, philosopher, and Burning Man champion Caveat Magister joins John and Maggie for a wide-ranging discussion. They explore turning your life into art, psychomagic, the role of magic and symbolism, immersive art, and much more.
I'm John Lepkoski here in Austin, Texas. And beaming in from Taos, New Mexico, that's Maggie Duvall. And our guest tonight is Caveat Magister from San Francisco. So we're coming in from all over the place. Welcome. Hey, Caveat.
Hello, hello.
How are you doing?
Pretty good. It is bright and sunny out in San Francisco, but I've spent most of the day inside, so.
Or are you writing? Are you working on something?
A whole bunch of things. I tend to work on a lot of projects at once rather than deep diving into one thing for a day. I do that occasionally, but most of the time I'm multitasking a lot.
Right. And you know, one of the things that we're going to be talking a lot tonight about is your latest book, Turn Your Life into Art, which I just finished. I've also read the, what was the other one? The Cities one. It's been a while.
Became Cities.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes. And, I want to, there's a lot of thoughts that are just bubbling up in my head. I know that you get asked all the time about Burning Man and the culture of Burning Man thought. I don't really want to talk about that tonight. So, because there's plenty out there. There's a bunch of wonderful stuff on your website, a lot of talks you've given and so on and so forth. But the book is about what you call the psychomagical or psychomagic. Mm-hmm. And I want to dive into that. But first, I wanted to note, it just brought me great joy that you use the word numinous a lot. Mm-hmm. And it's a favorite word of mine. And if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to go into what you define as psychomagic and then talk about the numinous related to that.
I got the impression that you were going to read a definition of the numinous, or do you want me to?
I would like you to, yes.
Okay, sure. So first of all, I should give credit where it's due. The term psychomagic came from Alejandro Jodorowsky. I have absolutely taken his term and applied it. I did not invent this concept. Oh, very good. You're so prepared.
I read it during the pandemic. Keep going. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'm mostly sticking with what I understand his definition to be, but you know, I'm sort of adjusting it slightly for the scene that I'm talking about as well. And the key element of psychomagic is this, that there are experiences we have that profoundly move us, that change us, that make it seem like we are indeed in the presence of something magical, something, to use the word that we're going to talk about in a moment, numinous, that life is different than when we thought, that it is more magical, it is more engaged, more is possible. And what are these experiences? In the Burning Man context, they tend to just be called transformative experiences. I think psychomagical is actually a better term for it. And these experiences, Jodorowsky told us, come from out of the fact that in the majority of our lives, most of what we do, we are engaged with our conscious minds, but that is not the majority of who we are. We have access to the conscious, but most of what we are doing happens in the realm of bodily processes that we are not conscious of psychological processes that we are not conscious of, the unconscious, the subconscious, spiritual processes that we are not conscious of, the spirit, the soul. All of these are things that our conscious mind doesn't have direct access to, but that really impacts us tremendously. You know, I mean, obviously, you know, your heartbeat is a key element of what is going on in your life, your blood pumping, even if you aren't aware of it on a moment-to-moment basis. Your unconscious frames your sense of how the world works. It frames your sense of what's possible, of what is good, of what is bad, of all kinds of things. We follow these patterns in our lives that we're not even aware of, but we're still doing it because a part of us is moved and motivated by our unconscious, by our psyche, our larger psyche. And when we want to make changes in our lives, or when we want to really do something foundational, we generally can't do it on purpose, because we try to do it with our conscious languages. That is to say, right. We want to move our psyches. We want our psyches to do something for us. We want them to move. We want them to change. We want them to act. But we ask them to do it using the tools of the conscious mind. And the psyche doesn't speak the language of our conscious mind. It doesn't speak ordinary dialogue. It doesn't speak logical argument. It doesn't speak graph and analysis. It doesn't speak motivational exhortation. It doesn't do any of that. The languages the psyche speaks, Jodorowsky pointed out, are poetry, symbolism, archetype, magic, and action. Those are the things, those are the language that the psyche speaks. And if we want to move the psyche and have experiences that the psyche, that our deeper psyche really engages with, then what we have to do are speak to it in those languages. We have to communicate it in the language of magic and symbolism and poetry and archetype and action. We have to do things that are symbolically loaded in order to get our psyches to peek up and say, oh, wait, something's happening here. I can respond to this. I can engage with this. And when that happens, when we do that, those are psychomagical experiences. Those are experiences that it do indeed seem like the universe is turning in a different way, that the what we thought was impossible is now possible. And then we're having an experience of psychomagic. And the point is that you can design for these experiences. You can't make them happen. You can't force someone to have a psychomagical experience or guarantee that it's going to happen, but you can create conditions under which these experiences are more likely.
Like a container, like a fluid container, like a porous container, perhaps.
Right. A liminal space in many ways. And when you design that well, it's much more likely that lightning is going to strike, that fairies are going to come live in your garden, these kinds of things. And so that's what psychomagical experiences are. And the numinous, which is a term that I first encountered through Carl Jung's work, is an experience or object. It's the characteristic of a kind of a charge, a sacred charge. If you encounter something that's numinous, you are not just intellectually impressed by it, but you are struck intuitively, instinctively, almost bodily by its sacred power. Right. That is the impact of the numinous.
Right. And I was introduced to that term through the cosmologist Brian Swim. Mm-hmm. If anybody's ever seen Brian Swim speak, when he talks about science and the universe, he's like it's like how Carl Sagan had that, like, just excitement, that gasp of like, don't you see the magic in the world? Mm-hmm. So you're saying that, like in reading in the book and all that, it sounds like there's people, I've talked to many of them, who are looking for some kind of formula, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, how to make this happen. In my own experience, the most, I say, psychomagical experiences I've had have been off the cuff, completely mm-hmm. random. There's mm-hmm. not a thing I go to per se. Right. It's so I wanted you to speak to that a little bit. And then I wanted to talk about miracles without religion. So
sure. Yeah, formula is in many ways the enemy. The more formulaic you get, the more your subconscious, your unconscious start to tune things out. Actually, one of the chapters in my book, Turn Your Life into Art, is specifically about how you can't create a mechanistic experience if you are trying to create the conditions under which psychomagic happens. You can't make it a machine or a robot where input A will lead to output B, which will lead to reaction C. It's not like that. That just doesn't work. What does work is creating what I call an infinite magical garden. You are, again, creating moments of beauty, of profundity, of radical honesty. And in doing these things, you make it more likely that a psychomagical experience is going to happen. But again, you're not just doing a thing and getting an output. You are creating the conditions under which something can happen. And one of the key elements of this, one of the things that I think is least understood by people who are trying to make these moments happen automatically, formulaically, is that the psychomagic isn't happening in the event. It's happening in the mind of the person experiencing it. It's not that you are doing A, B, and C and suddenly psychomagic is created. It's that you are doing something that reaches the person who is participating in it, and their unconscious says, hey, there's something interesting happening here, and I can understand this, and I want to play with this. I want to emerge, and I want to engage, and that's where it's happening. And so the people will sometimes come to me and say, hey, I tried doing this experience. Is that a psychomagical thing? Well, that creates psychomagic. And well, it depends on the person who it's engaged with. It's never happening out in the world. It's happening in the psyche of the person who is experiencing it. That's where it is. And that can lead to, you know, like, it means that so many things can be unexpectedly psychomagical, but it also means that you can't design it without the participant in mind. And they have to have agency. Their agency, their sense of meaning about the whole thing is absolutely crucial.
Right. And that going beyond that idea of interactive or whatever, it feels like an energetic exchange. They're like, the teacher is learning from the student and the student's learning from the teacher.
In many ways, you are activating the psyche of the person who is engaged in it, and then you're following where it goes. You're right. Not leading it so much as you are coaxing it out to play and then doing what it wants to do. There is a way in which trying to create these experiences, I've said it, without the recipient in mind, without following where they lead, it just doesn't work. It feels like an imposition rather than an invitation.
Right. And there's also one of the other discussions I've had frequently is whether it's a personal growth workshop or an event or whatever, like, you're really in it at the time with so many of them, mm-hmm. but then you leave and it just kind of vanishes. You're not left with anything. There's this frustration. Whereas more of a transformative experience, a psychomagical experience, to me, it feels like it continues to ripple out and spawn new things. Is that correct?
If you do it well. There's a big difference between trying to motivate people and exhorting people and actually letting them express themselves in a way that, you know, that is meaningful to them. And one of the big differences, I mean, this is, I come across something a lot in which people assume that any immersive or interactive experience is necessarily psychomagical. That's what psychomagical means. Well, you're immersed in it. You're interacting with it. No. We have immersive and interactive experiences, some of which are beautiful and lovely all the time, that are not psychomagical. And part of that is that psychomagical experiences tend to involve giving the recipient of them meaningful choices. That is to say, they're not just following along. They are choosing what to do. They are choosing how to engage. And that the choices that they make actually have a significant impact on the experience that they have. That's one of the key design elements for the kind of psychomagical experience that I'm talking about in this book. And lacking that element, you are much less likely to get a profoundly psychomagical experience, let alone one that actually lasts and changes people, that is transformative. And I think that's precisely because an experience that is immersive and interactive but doesn't offer meaningful choice, well, there's nothing at stake. There's nothing really at stake. Whereas when you start to allow people to make choices that really mean something, especially to them and to the experience they're having, that can have a transformative effect. That opens up a whole lot of doors of potential for a deeper, more lasting impact.
Right. Yeah. I loved what you were talking, you know, those choices and also the whole idea of the danger and the risk. There's just something in me that has a feeling of, it's almost like that Kate Bush video of Breathe, where she's like pushing that membrane, like wanting to stretch and like, you're not sure what's beyond that. So many experiences to me have felt, you know, way over-programmed, sanitized for your protection. You know, and I've always been someone who enjoys sometimes not to my benefit doing the free fall, because I wanted to see, I can't help myself. It's fear of missing out. I want to see what happens next. Right.
Yeah. No, these experiences are not benign. And I mean, it should be recognized that, yeah, there's of course an element of danger there. There is the possibility of something going wrong, but this comes along with the fact that you are giving people the opportunity to make meaningful choices. When you reach into someone's psyche and activate something, invite something that doesn't usually get to express itself, there's a potential for danger there. So they're being honest. When you follow where that goes, you don't know what's going to happen next. There's a potential for danger there. When you let people, especially people in those states, make meaningful choices and decisions, there's a potential for danger there. And that's not something that needs to be taken away in order to make the experience safe. That's actually something that makes the experience possible. And of course, that means there are ethical concerns with you know, offering people these kinds of experiences. Absolutely. But the answer is not to try to sanitize everything or overprogram everything and make it safe. It's to get better at working with danger. It's to get better at working with dangerous things so that you can keep people safe.
Right, exactly. And it's we have a question from the audience I'll ask in just a minute. I'm just acknowledging that, mm-hmm. John. There was something in that in the approaching risk and too that made me just popped in my mind the whole idea of the parents who don't trust you enough to let you make your own mistakes, right? Mm-hmm. So there's something beautiful in that. It's like, for those of us like me that didn't have that, right? You know, you have to, I will tell you everything for your whole path, right? Yeah. I left, that's when I left to go to California and hit at the right time, right? So that I could go like, I want to try this out for myself. Mm-hmm. I want to see what happens. I wanted magic in my life. I wanted weirdness in my life, right? So I think that that's really cool. There's that element.
The parental metaphor is a good one in many ways because, especially if you're talking about transformative experiences, because people can't grow for you. People Right. cannot grow on your behalf. They can't do it in a way that keeps you safe from the consequences of your own actions. They can't grow for you. And the attempt Right. to do that always fails as a transformative experience. If you want people to have a transformative experience, you need to let them lead. You need to let them make decisions. You need to let them engage, and you need to let them make the choices and face the consequences. That's just it's just the only way that works.
Well, and I also think too that when that's not allowed to happen, I have the image in my mind of the iris on the camera. When it's closed down, it's like there's this backing up. I think a lot of depression and frustration in our society is because there's not that opening to experience. And so it's turned back on ourselves. But when it's allowed to come out in a psychomagical experience or a place like Burning Man, where you're allowed to express your particular passion. Right. And as I heard you say in an interview, when the community accepts you in that mm-hmm. role, and then it just magnifies the whole, like what a great thing that is. So
there is a deep need, a deeply human need to be seen and to express yourself authentically and to have what you express be heard at the level of depth that you think it exists at. These are profoundly human needs, and they're not needs that our society right now is good at fulfilling. We're actually quite terrible at it. For all that, you know, we are a compulsively self-expressive society, you know, online, everywhere. For all that's happening, very few people feel like they are authentically engaging with the world, and very few people feel that they are seen for who they are, the depth they are at. And these when you don't have that, it creates problems. It, you know, we react to that.
And I think it's there was another in one of your interviews. I listened to a whole bunch of them. A bit about that I think that like Burning Man, we will touch on Burning Man, will have like fulfilled its purpose when this is out there, right? It's like that this is happening in every little community everywhere, right? Which has been a passion of mine for a long time. It's like, hey, I love this experience once a year, but I'd really like this in my community. So
I'm a big believer that Burning Man will have fulfilled its purpose when there is no more need for Black Rock City.
Right. I think that's incredible. So before I, you know, because I'll start babbling and then I'll forget this question here. Our friend Benjamin Fradley submitted the question on YouTube. Can you give an example of a psychological experiment or psychomagical, excuse me, experiment which was initially unsuccessful but redeemed by a midway shift? Is his question.
Initially unsuccessful but redeemed by a midway shift. The answer is almost certainly, but nothing is coming to mind immediately. However, I can tell a story about an experience where I wasn't sure what was happening midway through and had to make.
Okay.
So right before the pandemic came down, this was a series of art experiments. I called them my mad art experiments that I was doing just prior to the pandemic, and the pandemic, you know, shut that all down, and I'm hoping to pick them up again and starting the process of that. But I was taking a Burning Man experience that I had pioneered on the Playa and then was doing with people off Playa and going around, a one-to-one experience that I've written about this actually. And it involved taking a large book of fables.
Awesome.
About 100, there should be 100 unique stories in that binder, each of which is a page. And what I would do is, you know, the experience is I would let people pick a story out of that, but they had to do it while they were on an egg timer for separate minutes. And right. There's no way in which you can pick your story, the one that you really want to have rationally. You know, it's 100 pages, all of which are beautifully laid out with a lot of images, and the only way you can really decide is to fall back on your instincts. There's no way that you can do it rationally. And mm-hmm. So people would do that, and that was the essence of the experience. In late 2019 and early 2020, actually, I was try an experiment in which I would have people do this art experience, but I would put them under hypnosis first. And while they were in a trance state, I would first, you know, have them go through and find the stories that they felt they needed to have that was meant for them personally. And, you know, I gave them suggestions about being more in touch with their intuition and being able to make, you know, intuitive leaps. And then when they picked it out, I would read it to them while they were in a hypnotic state, but do so having given them instructions that they would experience this fully, that they were, it was a full sensory experience, that they were actually present and engaged in it. And the first time I did this with someone, the very first time, midway through the story, while he's in a trance state, he starts to cry.
Oh, wow. He's
starting to weep. And I've never had this happen before. I've never had someone cry while under hypnosis at all. I've had people cry when they were reading their stories. I mean, this is designed to be a very powerful experience,
but not
like this. And wow. I had to make the decision on the fly, literally as I was reading it to him, okay, do I shut this whole thing down or do I keep going? I mean, I don't know what these tears mean. I don't know what is really causing them. And I decided that the best thing to do was to keep going because if I immediately stopped it, then I knew something would be going wrong. Whereas, you know, if I finished it up, I could then, you know, and as I did, you know, then try to make sure that the experience was cathartic. You know, we could talk it through as a complete experience, but I really didn't know.
Right.
And indeed, after it was all done, he confirmed that had been the right decision, that they were cathartic tears, that he was, you know, the story he had picked was really touching on something that was, he was struggling with actively in his life. And so to experience it that way was profound and cathartic. And so it was a good experience. But yeah, there was a point in that moment where I had no idea what the right decision
right.
was.
And that's interesting that you followed your intuition, right? That because that, you know, just being in touch to know that instead of going to total panic, right? Like, no, what do I do? Right.
And this is back to the idea of being good with danger. I couldn't afford to panic. I mean, it wasn't
right.
You know, it wasn't me that was in risk at risk there. It was him.
Right.
And so, you know, I had to be able to think on my feet and, you know, I suss up the situation quickly and make what was hopefully an informed decision because this wasn't about me in this moment.
Right.
It was not about me. It was about him.
But there's something in there, like inadvertently channeling what he needed, right? Mm-hmm. That's brilliant.
The experience of, I mean, this is something else that we talk about and I talk about in the book, that performance skills are only so useful in creating mm-hmm. these kinds of psychomagical experiences. And it's precisely because when you're performing at someone, and it can be brilliant and it can be artistic and it can be moving, but it doesn't actually really involve the other person. Whereas the necessary skill, I talk with you know, Henry Andrews and Scott Levkoff about this in the book, they say it's channeling. It's being able to open up that connection to someone and then let something through and then be present in it as right. and with them, as opposed to performing at them. Her channeling skills in that sense are much more important than performance skills. Yeah.
Well, and it's interesting too, because in, you know, more like in the, like the esoteric healing world, it's mm-hmm. the whole idea of like, I'm not the healer. Right. I'm, you know, whatever that, you know, thy will, thy, the higher good and all that stuff is what you say. I have nothing to do with it. Right. It's, you know, just allowing it to come through. So I think that's interesting. And that's something I want to touch on. There's another question I'm going to ask you from Benjamin in a minute here that I want to circle back. And I'm hoping I won't forget before the end, because there's something about your work that is the mystical side mm-hmm. of the outer, you know, face of the event, just sort of like mystic Christianity, mystic Judaism, mm-hmm. Islam. So anyway, I'll touch on that later. I want to get to Benjamin's second question here. He asked, is it possible to create psychomagical experiences in which the participants are the only actors, no staff, and mm-hmm. what are the associated challenges?
Yeah. It is absolutely possible. And in many ways, those are the most profound, is when, you know, you are just doing this with someone else and you're having the experience together. You set up the conditions and you're having the experience together rather than doing something at someone or for someone. That is absolutely possible. And what are the conditions? I mean, it's easiest to do with someone who you know something about. A lot of the work that I have done in past years involves things that I can just offer to strangers. For example, you know, the Burning Man experience I was just talking about, that's mm-hmm. something that I can just offer to a stranger here and now, maybe without the definitely without the hypnotic element, less so.
Right.
Still, it's, you know, complete stranger, sure, got a thing, gonna do it. And that's been a hallmark of a lot of my personal artwork in this field. But you can have really profound moments when you know the other people involved and are working together towards some kind of common aesthetic goal. I had a profoundly moving experience not too long ago when a artist who I have worked with very closely over the years, and we're really sort of in each other's heads and our unconsciouses, got together, and we agreed to do this. And so we met at my place, and first she interviewed me for about an hour, talking about what's on my mind right now, what am I struggling with, what am I grappling with, what's happening here, and then making designs on the fly for each thing. But she didn't show them to me. So she, for each of the things that I was talking about, she created images and sigils and the like. And then after about an hour of that conversation, we laid a tarp on the floor. I stripped, and she painted all of those images on my body for the next 5 hours. And I didn't know what they were. And so, you know, and then at the end of that, we got up and I was able to see what I had become, see this on me, see what the symbols were, see.
Wow.
And that was, oh my God, that was just such a profound and moving experience. It just,
yes.
You know, absolutely. And it was for her too. We talked about this. This was not something that she was, it felt very much like a collaboration to a degree mm-hmm. that, you know, was actually somewhat startling to me. It wasn't like something she was doing to me. It was something that we in the moment, in the energy of it, and the flow and the mental state was felt very collaborative and profound. That was a deeply moving experience.
Very powerful. And like making the word flesh. And I think that's incredible. That's those again, those moments in time where it's like those Matrix films where everything stops and there's this moment of clarity and you can see like everything around you. And there's that hunger that we all have for that. And I think I just really have admired your book because you're speaking to that quite a bit, you know, circling back again to miracles without religion. Mm-hmm. And we'll circle back again about the mystic side of things. So speak to that a little more, if you wouldn't mind.
One of the things, I mean, this is something that I think is an important distinction is that, you know, we didn't invent psychomagic in this, you know, this scene that I'm talking about. And it's not just that, you know, Alejandro Jodorowsky actually came up with the word and he came up with it to describe other people doing other things. It's right. That psychomagic is common throughout the world. I mean, you know, I can't imagine there's a culture that doesn't have elements of it in some ways. And it's often very religious. It's often comes in religious iconography and religious experiences. You know, that's in many ways it's home. One of the things that is remarkable about the psychomagical scene that emerged in the San Francisco Bay Area from, you know, the more or less the 80s to more or less 30 years is that it was a psychomagical scene that was largely founded by atheists and materialists.
Right.
it's not that there weren't spiritual people involved, but right. It is a school of psychomagic that makes no epistemological claims whatsoever. It's not saying you have to believe in this in order to do this. It's not saying some spiritual entity, you know, does such and such. We're not invoking anything in particular. That you have these experiences, you have these miraculous experiences, and all you have to do is participate. You don't have to believe in anything in particular. You don't have to adopt any particular creed. And that, I think, is unique and is very important. And in that sense, when you have enough people doing this with each other, for each other, enough, then yeah, you have miracles without religion. You have, you know, right. a scene in which everyone is a priest and every ritual is unique, and, you know, never repeated. And it's really quite extraordinary.
Yeah, and I think there's something really amazing about the, again, when I got to the Bay Area, mm-hmm. and the first thing I saw was a guy in a chicken suit riding a bike down the street, and I thought, I just fell to the ground and said, I'm home, I have found my people.
Yeah.
What I loved was the absurdity, the not taking anything seriously, the pranksterism, I was like, finally. Yeah. You know, and I think that, you know, I'm always, what interests me always is the spirit of something and not it becoming what I would call encased in amber or codified or dogmatized.
Yeah.
And there's just that irreverence to, there's so much irreverence and it just, you know, it gladdens the heart, you know, it opens the heart, the laughter, but also it brings the tears, you know, it's just, yeah.
This is another area in which the San Francisco School of Psychomagic is distinct, is its emphasis on the whimsical and right. not just the irreverent, although certainly that, but right. the whimsical, that, you know, these experiences can be profound and moving, but also playful and absurd. And you don't privilege the one over the other. If you're going too long without the whimsical and the absurd, then you are making it less of an experience, not more. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's more of without a top-down structure, there is a kind of checks and balances that just is naturally flowing. And it's almost like we talk about here in Taos, that, you know, if the mountain doesn't like you, it'll spin you out. It's just the kind of idea that if you can't work within the flow, the energy of the place, and it's not, and I'm not talking about, you know, like, oh, or like that. I'm like, you know, if you, you know, and so anyway, that's babbling a bit.
Over the years, I've actually become a big believer in psychogeography in the sense that
interesting.
Just as every environment has its own, just as every place has its own unique physical environment, that every place has its own unique psychological environment. And you don't have to, you know, go into the mystical to believe that. It's, you know, right. It's the architecture, it's the people, it's the habits of the culture, but that, yeah, that it, each place creates its own sort of unique psychological environment. And it's very hard to be in a place where you are constantly at odds with that psychology, with the geography.
Right, yeah.
Whereas when you're in a place that wants you to have the same kinds of experiences that you want to have, oh, that's amazing.
I love that you said that, because I've been thinking about that a lot. You know, the areas where I have not really fit, mm-hmm. the areas I have. And when we were talking earlier about, you know, places and you know, spirit of a place and so on, immediately who popped into my head was David Abram. Are you familiar with his work? He wrote a book called The Spell of the Sensuous, and another one called Becoming Animal, that I think that...
No, I'm not familiar with that.
I think that you would completely resonate with his work, because it's about magic in nature, and in the, you know, from the minutiae to the greatest thing, that, you know, getting into that space where you can, you're aware of it. And he trained early as a magician. So anyway, check him out. We have another question for you. This one is from Jane Clark. Given the special circumstances that nurtured the groups you write about in this recent book, have been forced out of the city. What cities do you see now, I can read, are supporting groups doing similar work?
I have to be honest, I don't feel like I'm educated to answer that. I would like to be, but I'm not. And candidly, my pandemic experience shrunk my world a great deal. There are ways in which, you know, during much of the pandemic, I no longer felt like I even knew San Francisco anymore, let alone the rest of the world. So I don't know where I could point you and say that's an up and coming center of psychomagical experience. I'm sorry. I would love to hear people's input on that. What I will say though is that anyone can do this, and it is entirely possible to reach out into your own communities and say, hey, you know, can we play at something?
Right.
You know, you with people who are unfamiliar with it, you can't go from 0 to 60, obviously. You know, you have to sort of, you know, let them in somewhat gently, but that's okay. You can build it up. The hunger for this sort of experience, I think, is real, and so it is possible to this is all a dodge for my honestly wishing I knew.
Well, I'll pop in on this a little bit. I really feel that it's almost like I keep bringing up these images, right? But it's the dandelion seeds, right? It feels like the age when there would be a place, like there was the music scene. You know, I remember another reason I moved to California was more of a music scene than there was in Denver at the time, right? But I don't feel personally that's happening anymore. It's now the time for the dispersion. So maybe those mentors, those teachers that have been in more concentrated areas where there's the Burning Man or regional burns, so on and so forth, are moving out. I mean, I know a lot of people like me that have left Austin because it's not working for us anymore. But I'm already connecting in with people in this community that not wanting to create burn events per se, but more like what the, you know, just general transformative experiences. So it'll be interesting to see where this goes, just like, you know, after the early... You know, I wonder if anybody's ever cataloged all of the different like events, businesses, whatever that emerged from that flashpoint of the first Burning Man. You know, like it's got to be astronomical at this point.
I would like to think that we have an effect like this going on. I would like to think so. And certainly, you know, in terms of places, you know, New York City has had a lot going on in theater and art, and, you know, absolutely has had a lot of psychomagical experiences happening there. So I don't know if there's still currently a center of it. I don't know the scene there at all right now, but in the past they have been. The Los Angeles Cacophony Society actually was in many ways superior to the San Francisco one for a period of time. Just
Reverend
some of the it's just legendary. So so it certainly has happened. I've had some extraordinary experiences in Prague. So, you know, I think that's just a magical city that way. But yeah, no, I would really like to think that the very real dispersal that is happening as, you know, people get gentrified out of the San Francisco Bay Area is spreading seeds. I hope so.
Right, right. Yeah, and I also think about the, you know, I'm a minister of spiritual science, and I've done a lot of weddings, and a lot of the people I've married have worked with me because they wanted that spiritual feeling, and they miss the community. They don't go to church anymore, but they miss the feeling of the connection and the community and all that. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like, you know, there's something in this about a new kind of church without, again, the structure, you know. And I'd like you to talk a little bit more about, you know, you had to work a lot in the book, and I'm sure you do, and a lot of your discussions to, because again, it seems like everybody's looking for a formula.
Mm-hmm.
And could you talk a little bit more about that? You know, because it feels like there's a little bit of a point being lost.
All too often there is. I mean, we want these experiences to be instantly accessible. I mean, I think, okay, one of the problems that artists are having right now, broadly, not just psychomagically, is a problem of cultural success. There has never been a time in history when art was more accessible to more people, where you could just go hear music on demand, right, where you could just see images on demand. I mean, you know, television and movies didn't used to exist, and now you see them on demand, streaming whenever you want. We are
surrounded
by art and culture. We've come to see it as a kind of a utility. You know, it's like tap water. You know, and that's how we want it. If, you know, we of course we don't want to have to go to the well, you know, every other day in order to haul our water back. And we want the same thing with our art. We want it to be on demand. We want to get it when we want it, how we want it, to pause it and, you know, do something else and then come back to it. And that's completely understandable. I completely understand that. But psychomagical experiences don't work that way. There are no shortcuts. There is no abbreviation. There is no streaming service version of it. You actually have to put in the work of designing the experience and then being present with people when they have it and doing the channeling each and every time and finding new ways to be radically honest and playful and to come up with experiences that are not benign and that offer meaningful choice. I mean, you have to do this every time. Okay. There are ways in which it gets simpler and easier for you as you get better at it, as you get better and better at the skill. Of course, you know, some things come easier, but there are no shortcuts to it. You never get to scale it. You never get to just, you know, put it on repeat. And so people are looking in that sense for an experience that is as convenient as all the other experiences that they have in that they think of as utilities. You know, they want it on tap, they want it on demand, and it doesn't work that way. This is something that you can't do this way. You actually have to fully engage in every single time.
Right, right. Yeah, and what comes to mind a little bit is when I was a little girl and I'd play store. The fun part was putting it together and imagining what we could do with it and all that. Mm-hmm. But then when we started playing with it, it was like, okay, it's not working. Right. So, you know, a lot of, you know, there's a lot of great work out there from, you know, let's say Meow Wolf, right? And, you know, they got these great installations, and I've been to the one in Santa Fe twice. Mm-hmm. And after the first, it's all wonderful. It's great, wonderful mm-hmm. art and all that. But after the first experience at Meow Wolf, it was just kind of meh, you know, it was great and all that, but I'm, you know, it didn't feel quite as, it's just not transportable. It's not translatable. And, you know, I like that there was the ability to, you know, explore as you would in that environment. But I think it's missing that other step. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I know a lot. So first of all, I should admit that I have never actually been to a Meow Wolf installation, so I can't speak to that personally.
Right.
But I know a lot of people who I consider great artists who have, right. And their reaction is generally similar to yours. Well, first of all, some of them are really angry that Meow Wolf is now synonymous with immersive art because, you know, Meow Wolf didn't invent it.
And right. That's what I was thinking. I was wondering about. Yeah.
Now, anytime you say I do immersive art, they say, oh, like Meow Wolf. Well, no, actually, it's not like, so there's that. And I want to say that also nobody begrudges Meow Wolf their immense success. Right. I mean, you know, artists making a living doing this fantastic.
What a concept. Yes.
Yeah. They're bringing great experiences to so many people. So wonderful. But right. The critique I've heard from people whose opinions on this I trust is precisely that they are creating immersive environments. And they're very impressive immersive environments, and you know they're doing that very very well. But that there aren't these other elements that really makes it psychomagical. That there isn't really anything at stake. That right. There is no real. It is a benign experience. It's a very cool experience, but it is a benign experience. That you have the ability to choose where you go in the installation, but you don't actually make meaningful choices above and beyond that. It's lacking that element that actually pushes it over into psychomagic. Although again, I have to say that, you know, the psychomagic happens in the minds of the people experiencing it. Right. And so, you know, if someone goes to Meow Wolf and leaves, right. No, I had a psychomagical experience. Okay.
Totally. Yeah. They could have met somebody in that room who did something that had nothing to do with Meow Wolf that, you know,
or viewing the thing actually did it for them. I mean, it is entirely possible to have a psychomagical experience just of what we would call ordinary art, you know, someone seeing a painting for the first time, right. Someone seeing, the Mona Lisa, or, when I first started to see, I'd seen images online and in art books of the Pre-Raphaelites all the time. But then when I went to a museum and finally saw a Pre-Raphaelite in person, I started going, oh, this is different. You know, it is, if it moves you that way, if it rouses your unconscious, then yeah, absolutely. But what we're talking about are the conditions under which this is a more likely experience, designing to make it more likely. And it does seem like Meow Wolf is lacking a number of those elements, even as they are doing other things profoundly right.
Absolutely right. Yeah. Thanks for that feedback, because that's kind of where I'm at, right? You know, and love it all. What was the other thing I was thinking about? I really like that you know, there's a tendency in some of these. Some of the other experiences I've had that I wouldn't call psychomagical, but pretty profound and extraordinary, interactive, whatever, where there was almost like a caste or a priesthood of the makers doing this. You mentioned an avoidance of, did I drop out there for a minute?
You did for a moment, yeah.
Okay. There is a, what was I asking?
Priesthood was what I last heard.
Yeah. There's kind of like this, this idea that there's kind of a rarefied air of the creators. It's like Star Trek or something. Like, and I don't get that at all from what you're describing. It's very distributed networking. Mm-hmm. You know, there's not the hierarchy. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Is that co-creation?
There's a lot of co-creation involved, at least if you do it right. But I think there are different visions of what the good is in this sense. I think that, again, much in the way that the rest of society has gone, there is an impulse in which people want artists to be heroic. They want artists to be these heroic figures, these priestly figures who come in and work magic and have secrets, and that's very cool. I mean, it is. There is and you meet people who can actually fill that role, and oh my God, they're kind of amazing. So I get the appeal to that. I really do.
Right.
But if you want more psycho magic in the world, if you want a more magical world, then you want everybody to be able to do it.
Right.
And once everybody can do it, and if they do this for each other, then the world gets a lot more interesting. And so that's where I come out on this. I mean, you know, there's a romantic allure to the underground, right, which is a phrase Larry Harvey once used. And I get it. You know, we've all felt that. But I think of it as sort of literacy. You know, if you want more if you want more novels in the world, if you want more short stories in the world, then you want more people to be literate, not fewer. I mean, you know, you won't have as many giants of short stories and novels, because it'll be distributed. You know, it'll be once everybody can play, it changes things, and it's harder to find the, you know, great men of the art. But you have so much more, and it gets so much better. You know, once television got opened up to more and more kinds of people creating shows, it got a lot better. We're in a golden window now, precisely because it's been opened up to more people and more kinds of people. And I think it's the same thing here. You know, there was, as the West secularized, which I don't think it ever really did, but as it went into this period, you know, in many ways, art and therapy started to occupy the place that God and religion had used to have for masses of people, not for everyone, right, clearly, but, you know, but for a whole lot of people, art and therapy began to take up the role that God and religion had once had. And I don't think art and therapy are very good in that role, actually. I completely understand why people did that. I know the impulses. I, you know, have made that mistake myself. But artistic techniques and the making of art and therapeutic techniques and the being there for one another, they're better when they are distributed. And that doesn't mean that there won't be people who are better at it than others, you know, and there won't be, right, people who are really focusing their time on it, studying their craft. There's never going to be a point at which everyone is equally good at this.
Right.
But the more distributed it is, the more people have access to these experiences and these tools, the more of a magical world we're going to have, the more of a world that is artistic we are going to have, the more of a world that is, you know, therapeutically helpful for people we are going to have. And so I think, yeah, avoiding making these the tools of the priestly priestly caste of saying it's for them but not for us, I think we want to avoid that. I think we want them as distributed as we can get them.
Well, and I thank you, and I agree with that. And I one of my passions in life has been about, in my own weird ways, whether I was conscious of it or not, helping people to see how brilliant they are, you know, things about themselves that they couldn't even see.
Yeah.
And supporting them to take the steps to explore that, right? Because it's like, hey, if you're not feeling like oppressed and repressed and all that, everyone's happier. Yay, mm-hmm, we can do all sorts of fun stuff, yeah, together. So, you know, I do like the benevolent subversiveness. Can't help myself. Just really quick, two things I wanted to touch on. Just circling back again to you know, talking a little bit more about the Burning Man, philosophical, you know, all of that. Mm-hmm. And I sort of was vaguely aware that this sort of thing was going on, but I've been removed for a while. Mm-hmm. But there is a kind of a, feels like that, you know, when people talk about the negative part of Burning Man, the positive, blah, blah, everybody's, you know, fisticuffs, like who's right, who's right. there is always the outer form of something, and then there's the inner spirit of it. And it seems like a lot of your work is exploring and addressing that. So I just wanted to show my appreciation as the mystic I am. And just wanted to throw out a sort of speculative question to you. Mm-hmm. if you could have the world be any way you want, you know, like if you could have this turn your life into art, be everywhere on the planet, how would it manifest? How would you love to see it manifested? Does that make sense what I'm asking? Like, no holds barred, you know, oh, we can't do that because of this. Like, what do you see?
Part of me doesn't want to answer the question because I think there's a utopian element to that. That says, you know, if we could just get this right, then everything would be perfect. And
right.
And as I, one of the lines that is in my Burning Man philosophy book over and over and over again is utopia is for suckers.
Right. And I think you said something in here about that. Probably. Yeah.
That, you know, we, that we can do things and make them better, but the moment we think, okay, we're going to reach a point, and if we just don't change anything, right, it'll be perfect, is the moment at which we start doing more harm than good.
Right.
This kind, not only is this kind of change inevitable, but it's actually, human beings are dynamic. We change, we grow, we learn, we engage, and you know, we're never going to lose the intrinsic motivation to do that. And so, and so part of me doesn't want to answer that question because I think I want to urge people to find out for themselves. I want to
say, well answered. Okay, go ahead.
I think what I would imagine we would see the more and more this spreads is, you know, maybe at some point there would be larger scale, you know, psychomagical endeavors, but that mostly or a lot at heart, it would be people doing this for their friends, for their loved ones, saying, hey, you know, can we create an experience together? Hey, I'm struggling with something. Let's create an experience for this. Hey, I have a birthday coming up. Could we come up with something that's really going to reach us? And for that matter, for strangers, you know, for offering strangers weird art gifts in the park, on the street. I think you would see it, and I think you'd see an explosion of it in small scale ways. And I think that people would try then, and bless them for trying to scale it up and, you know, come up with, you know, larger scale efforts and endeavors of it. But I think more often than not, that would actually move them away from the heart of the experience and not towards it.
Right. Yeah. When it gets codified, it just starts getting rigid and
It's more than that. Scaling involves looking for shortcuts, and there aren't shortcuts. I mean, Burning Man has gotten bigger than anyone ever imagined it could be, but I don't think Burning Man scales. I think Rock City can get big, has gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, but you know, the real expansion has been with the regionals, has been people doing events where they live, has been, you know, them forming that. And that's not scaling, that's doing it in their communities.
Right.
And I think that's exactly how this works effectively.
Trying
to scale it and say, well, you know, we can get more people if we just, you know, if we just cut corners, or we just, you know, eliminate this part, or we find efficiencies. That doesn't work.
Well, yeah, with anything, this is, I'm always complaining about, you know, you have a favorite pop-up cart, like a taco cart, and then all of a sudden they're a giant corporation and it doesn't taste the same anymore. It's just not the same. So that was great. Oh, 3 minutes left. Okay. So what I would like to do is ask you if there's something that I know there's a million things we could cover, but is there something we haven't covered that you would like to address or talk about? Or
I am always curious when I talk with people what their first experience of psychomagic was. So I'd love to hear that from you. It doesn't have to be when you knew what it was, but when you just first realized, oh, wait, there's this thing that exists in the world. There's a kind of experience I can have.
Let's see. God, there's been so many of them. This was one that wasn't created for me, it just sort of happened. I went over to England a few years ago, and I went to this community called Findhorn, and I was meditating in the original garden at Findhorn, and I was by myself, but then I heard a noise. I heard footsteps coming over to me, and I heard a newspaper rustling, you know, and I was trying not to pay attention. Mm-hmm. But then I crooked an eye, and there was this very tiny little man wearing little red breeches and shoes. And all, you know, it registered to me, this is a freaking gnome. There was a gnome sitting on the bench across from me, reading a newspaper, and he just nodded at me, and I closed my eye again, and I went back to what I was doing. Now, that was, I was open to it, apparently. Mm-hmm. Like, and I've told many people, like, yeah, it was a gnome, you know, it's like, he's probably about this big, sitting on the bench. I think it was the energy of the place. You know, Findhorn itself is like a container for magic to happen. So it wasn't a particular event,
right?
But it was definitely very magical.
That's it. Yeah, that's it. There's something more possible in the world. Yeah.
Right. Right. It was like seeing through dimensions. So, John, do you have one? I think we have 1 minute left.
Oh my gosh. Well, I don't know. I mean, I recall having an experience where for some reason I'd parked my car by the side of the highway and I had got outside for some reason and looked up at the sky, and suddenly everything was just one thing. It was kind of like similar to like a Satori Kensho kind of experience, you know?
Yeah, no, these experiences happen in the wild, as it were, all the time. The point is that we can also design them. We can also make them happen on purpose.
And we have reached the end of the hour. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. This is great.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.